We're going to take a short break for one of our sponsors. I haven't tried this one, but it looks well worth checking out if weight loss has been an ongoing challenge for you. Robody pairs medication options with diet and exercise modifications to achieve your desired goal. Before being prescribed any medication, patients complete an online medical visit, lab test, and more to see if you're right for their program. You can sign up online, which means no scheduling a doctor's appointment, no commute to the doctor's office, and no waiting rooms. Their data shows that average weight loss is 15 to 20% in 1 year with healthy lifestyle changes. BMI and other eligibility criteria apply. Go to ro.co/untangle. Sign up today and you'll pay just $99 a month for your first month and $145 a month after that. Medication costs are separate. That's ro.co/untangle. Now, back to our show. We're taking a short break to tell you a little bit about the 10% Happier podcast hosted by my friend Dan Harris. It has one guiding philosophy. Happiness is a skill you can learn, so why not master it? I recently talked to him on our show about what has changed since he wrote 10% Happier 10 years ago. A lot. Dan was once a fidgety, skeptical journalist, but after suffering a panic attack on national television, he decided to change his life. This journey led him to learn everything he could about the human psyche. Now he's on a quest to help others achieve peace and happiness. Each week, he talks to top scientists, meditation teachers, and even the odd celebrity, exploring topics like productivity, anxiety, enlightenment, psychedelics, and relationships. He's funny. He's smart. He's one of the best interviewers I know. Think of listening to 10% Happier as a workout for your mind. The 10% Happier podcast is available wherever you listen to podcasts. Welcome to Untangle, the podcast from Muse, the brain sensing headband that helps you meditate and sleep, and Meditation Studio, the 5-star app. I'm Patricia Karpus. I'm excited to share something new from Muse. If you're like the rest of us that struggle with getting a good night's sleep, you'll want to check out the new digital sleeping pill. It's an intuitive sleep guide. It's part of the next generation of Muse S, and it responds to your brain activity to help quiet your busy mind and guide you into a more restful sleep. It's a responsive kind of sleep experience that's designed to lull you to sleep and help you fall back to sleep if you wake up during the night. Check it out at choosemuse.com and use discount code LAUNCH15 to give it a try. Now, on to Ariel.
Hello, and welcome to another Untangle. My amazing guest today is going to inspire you to move your body to heal your brain and mind. She's Dr. Jennifer Heiss, and she's an award-winning cognitive neuroscience and an expert in brain health. She did her postdoc at the Center for Aging and Brain Health Innovation, and she's an associate professor at the McMaster University, where she directs the NeuroFit Lab, where she researches the effects of exercise for brain health. Two topics that I know you audience are interested in. Dr. Heiss's research examines the effects of physical activity on brain function to promote mental health and cognition, as well as in young adults, older adults, and individuals with Alzheimer's. She also was a triathlete, so she really knows this topic from the inside out. She has an awesome new book that launches tomorrow, which I've read cover to cover and love, called Move the Body, Heal the Mind. Today, we're going to learn all about the effects of exercise on the brain, and possibly most importantly, how you personally can harness these benefits to protect your own gray matter as you gray. Welcome, Dr. Heiss.
Hi, nice to be here.
It's wonderful to have you here. It is incredibly exciting. I must say, I loved every bit of your book because you explained so clearly exactly why it is that exercise is such a salve for the brain from a neurochemical aspect and also from a mental aspect like anxiety, depression, et cetera. And it's not necessarily what most people think.
That's right. Yeah. I was hoping to add in some new information that you haven't heard before. So I'm glad to hear.
And maybe you'll share some of that information that most people haven't heard before in today's episode.
I will.
I want to start with your own journey because it was really fascinating. You overcame a lot of mental difficulties and did so through exercise. Can you let us in on your own journey?
Yeah. So probably one of the biggest hurdles I overcame was some mental health issues that arose in grad school. So at the time, I was studying the fundamentals of neuroscience. How does the brain represent who we are as people and memories? And it became very clear to me that something wasn't quite right with my own brain. I was experiencing some severe anxiety, and although I had sought medical help, they didn't give me what I needed to get better. And so it was on a whim that I borrowed my friend's rusty old road bike, and the movement really soothed my mind. And it sparked a shift in not just my personal life with a love of exercise, but also my professional life. So I shifted away from the fundamentals of neuroscience and more to understanding how exercise changes the brain to promote mental health.
So what are some of the fundamental ways in which that happens? Let's start to dive into the mechanisms of it.
Yeah, so there's really a lot of fascinating ways that moving the body can heal the mind. Even just exercising the muscles and producing chemicals like lactate, which I'm sure a lot of people are familiar with. Lactate's often associated with that burning sensation in muscles when we work hard. And most fitness instructors want you to get rid of it. They're like, okay, let's flush out the lactate, as if it's a bad thing. But it turns out that lactate is one of the most powerful stimulators of neurogenesis. So it moves from the muscles through the blood directly to the hippocampus, and it promotes growth factors like brain-derived neurotrophic factor, which increases the health and function of cells, but also increases the birth of brand new cells.
That is amazing. They say no pain, no gain. But when we feel that lactic acid discomfort, which for so many people is a reason to stop exercising, you're like, oh, cramp in the leg, cramp in the tummy, better pull back. That is actually triggering neurogenesis. That's extraordinary.
Yeah, it's really fascinating. And so the message then is we need to pick up the pace, at least a little bit. And so for seniors or for older people, this can be somewhat intimidating. But I recommend starting out with an interval walk, which is a fun way to pick up the pace. So just, you can even make a game of it. You can pick up the pace between light posts or add a few hills into your walk. Anything that gets your heart rate up a bit and makes it difficult for you to have a conversation, then you know you're producing the lactate your brain needs to stimulate neurogenesis.
Wow. So this also takes me to a mindfulness concept for a second, which is the ability to sit with discomfort. So an interesting thing happens when you exercise, which is it can be incredibly uncomfortable. There can be a lot of pain. And we can jump to the conclusion that, oh no, because there's pain, because there's discomfort, I should stop doing this now. But one of the main things that we learn in mindfulness is the ability to be with the pain and to recondition our thoughts and feelings around it. Can you speak to that a little? I know you've got a lot to say in this domain.
Yeah, and I would maybe just caution that if you're feeling intense pain, don't push through it. A little bit of discomfort, like comfortably uncomfortable, is how I like to think of it, where you're just pushing yourself beyond your comfort zone. This is a really great space to be when exercising because it gives the body the stress, the good stress it needs to adapt and grow into a stronger version of yourself. And absolutely, mindfulness helps you become more comfortable with those uncomfortable sensations like slight burning in the muscles, or even just the boredom that sometimes you can experience if you're going for like a long run, especially if you're on that dreaded treadmill, you know, the boredom that you can experience. Mindfulness is really helpful. And there's a really interesting link. We've done some research in my lab showing that exercise promotes mindfulness and mindfulness makes it easier for you to exercise. So there's this bi-directional relationship between training the body and training the mind.
Why do you think that is?
I think that both of them, like maybe as you mentioned, they help us get comfortable with being a little bit uncomfortable, right? And so a lot of the benefits of exercise are slightly outside of that comfort zone. And if you can pay attention to breath, get out of your head and into your body. Even just focusing on things like glute squeeze or heel drive, then it helps you to stop worrying or stressing about the pain or the anguish or the boredom, and you start to really enjoy the movement. So the movement itself, having a mindful awareness, helps make the movement more enjoyable. And then when you're enjoying the moment in which you're moving, then you're more likely to stick with it over the long term.
Yeah, when you're no longer judging the experience of it, but you're inside the experience of it.
That's right. And I talk about in the book about this paradox between having a fitness goal, but not having it in mind when you're exercising. So it's good to have goals, yes. But if you're thinking about that goal and constantly perseverating on that goal while you're exercising, it actually can be a deterrent. And for a lot of people, one of their goals of exercising might be to lose weight. And so if they're focusing on, okay, I got to do this to lose weight and everything, they're not enjoying the experience and they're more likely to quit.
I also read an interesting study recently that your mere interpretation of your actions as exercise may indeed increase the benefit of the exercise. So they looked at maids at several different hotels. And some of them they told, you know, the work that you're doing is exercise and it's making you healthier. And others in the control group, they said nothing. And when they came back some months later, those who had been told that they were exercising had both a better perception of it and had lost several pounds on average each.
The placebo effect and the nocebo effect are strong influencers of how we feel when we exercise. So in the book, I talk about this really interesting interplay between pain perception, and movement. And so people who experience chronic pain, they could really benefit from movement. When we move our body, it increases endorphins, which are the body's natural painkillers, and this helps relieve pain. So movement is the medicine that people with chronic pain need. However, a lot of them fear that the movement will actually make their pain worse, and so they avoid it. And there's a study I talk about where they had patients with chronic back pain come into this study. One group was told, the exercise might increase your back pain slightly. And the other group was told, this is fine movement for you. Just this slight change in instructions, in mindset, in framing of the question caused the people who thought it was going to cause them a little bit of pain. They moved less fluidly. They felt more in pain. They moved as if they were in more pain. It really is mind over matter when it comes to movement.
Yeah, we created an entire course on pain with Dr. Ron Siegel. He has a great Untangle episode as well, all about pain and your perception of the experience of it. And part of the course is about starting to do movements that you're afraid of. Get clearance from your doctor that it's totally fine for you to walk up the stairs, do jumping jacks, do all these things that most people who have pain don't want to do because it causes pain. And the greatest irony is that as soon as you start to do them, you rewire your brain and neural associations with that movement, and you actually end up often releasing yourself from the pain through the action of doing something that was in and of itself painful.
I know, it's so amazing. And actually, the same thing works with anxiety. So a lot of people with anxiety also have an anxiety sensitivity, which is essentially the fear of fear itself. So they're afraid of the body sensations that anxiety produces, like racing heart, difficulty breathing, which also happen to be the sensations produced by exercise. So people with anxiety sensitivity are afraid of exercising. They're afraid of exercising vigorously. And I propose in the book that actually a vigorous burst of exercise is what they need. It's exposure therapy, exposing them in this controlled and safe environment to the sensations they fear the most. And so I recommend in the book, there's this fear buster workout where they go for a light to moderate walk. They build up this resiliency factor in their brain called neuropeptide Y. It soothes the anxious amygdala. And then they reframe and say, okay, let's do this. And then they sprint for just a few seconds. That's all it takes, just a few seconds of exposure at first to feel the heart race, feel the shortness of breath, and then come back down to baseline and know that you're okay. And that reassurance, exposing themselves to that, is so beneficial.
I want to dig down on this in a few different ways. So one, certainly somebody with a panic attack would be afraid of the symptoms of a racing heart, et cetera. But I think a lot of us are actually afraid of the symptoms of exercising, afraid of the sensation of your heart pounding, afraid of the feeling of discomfort in your legs or cramping, because it inherently feels like something must be wrong if that's happening. And so as you talk about this notion of exposure therapy for many, many people when they start their exercise, it's like, okay, you're going to push it on that on a quick little sprint or push it on your exercise bicycle for a minute. Your heart is going to pound. It's going to feel weird. You're going to have a whole bunch of sensations, and all of those sensations are okay. You're going to do it for 20 or 30 seconds, and then you're going to stop. You're going to come back down. You're going to look around and say, hey, actually, I am okay. All of that was fine. And that gives you the confidence to do it again. And this is standard operating procedure for exposure therapy for anything that we're anxious to. And it's so amazing that when we're able to do this in the controlled environment of exercise, that it then becomes something that allows us to have resilience in so many other parts of our life where you're like, oh, actually, I can approach that thing that I was afraid of because I know I'll just have a bit of sensation and then it'll abate and it'll be fine.
Yeah, this is the amazing thing that exercise gives, is this tolerance to stressful situations. So exercise is technically a stressor, right? It activates the stress system. It causes all the same sensations that regular psychological stressors cause, but in this controlled environment, and it tones our stress system, essentially. The real beautiful part about this is that we become less reactive to everyday stressors. So we learn, our body adapts, and we learn to bring the stress system back. So it'll be activated. There are stressors every day that we experience, but it won't be activated as high, and it'll be brought back down to baseline faster. So then we have a clear mind, a calm mind to deal with the situation appropriately.
We'll take a short break for one of our awesome sponsors, Born Shoes. I was so excited to try these cute, casual sandals made with top quality leather, perfect for all the traveling that I do. They're so comfortable for walking anywhere. I know exactly why their tagline is, "Take comfort in Born Shoes." Perfect. There are 5 new styles this spring, and I tried Ithaca and absolutely love them. But they also have boots and heels you should try. They feel as good as they look. Go to bornshoes.com today for a 15% discount plus ground shipping on all full price shoes when you use my promo code UNTANGLE. That's promo code UNTANGLE for 15% off and free shipping. Available exclusively to our listeners for just a limited time. Now, back to our show.
Can you dig a little bit more into the nervous and neural mechanisms of this toning? Let us know what the vagus nerve is doing. Let us know why these bursts of exercise actually allow us to be physiologically more resilient and better able to come back to baseline.
Yeah, so the vagus nerve is a really important factor in this, and that's part of the parasympathetic nervous system. So we have 2 parts of the autonomic nervous system, the sympathetic nervous system, which is the fight or flight, and the parasympathetic nervous system, which is rest and digest. And they need to be in balance. And when we exercise or when we're stressed and we get pushed out of that balance, the sympathetic nervous system dominates. And the parasympathetic nervous system has to somehow regain control or regain balance. And the more we exercise, the more that we tone, we're essentially toning the PNS. So it can lift heavier and heavier sympathetic load so that eventually, even when the stressor knocks the sympathetic system to dominate, the parasympathetic system can still maintain the balance in the body.
So basically, our vagus nerve becomes very good at very quickly returning us back to baseline.
That's right, yeah.
And exercise basically gives it the practice to do that in the safe way.
Exactly.
So it's interesting. You had mentioned earlier on the idea of stress and that exercise is safe stress. Is that what you meant by it?
Safe stress, yeah. It's controlled. we start it and stop it ourselves. This is different than a lot of psychological stressors that we don't control. We have no idea around when they're going to stop. And it's this uncontrollability, this uncertainty around psychological stressors that really make them damaging to our health.
So I love this idea that you can use exercise in an intentional way to push back against these stressors in your stress systems. I know a lot of people run because they say it's their meditation. Now, meditation and running are two different things. One can run meditatively, but running itself is not meditation. But there's this sensation that happens in your mind when you run of things going blank. Can you talk a little bit about this and the runner's high and what's happening there?
Yeah, so a lot of people think about movement and meditation. They often think about yoga or Tai Chi or maybe even Pilates, things that have this natural attention to breath. But you're right, you can form an attention to breath through any movement, including running or walking. And in particular, this idea of runner's high, it gets us to this state of pure bliss, right? And how does it get us there? Well, it increases two neurochemicals. So one your listeners are probably really familiar with, which is the endorphins that it releases. But it also releases endocannabinoids, which is the body's natural production of cannabis, which reports directly to the reward system in the brain and stimulates the release of dopamine that makes us just feel divine.
So anybody who gets runner's high is not making it up. You're getting the endorphins and the endocannabinoids. They're making you feel fantastic.
When they meet together in the reward system, it creates this additional, like, hedonic experience. And you get that with that long run.
And I bet you that hit of dopamine now makes that run seem very addictive, something you want again and again. So it's a self-perpetuating, motivating system.
That's right. It does. It reinforces itself. But we have to remember that feel-good feeling at the end of the workout, because it is hard. It's hard to stay motivated to exercise because, well, after all, it's hard work.
So let's talk a little bit about why the brain doesn't want us to exercise and how we can overcome that.
Yeah, this is a really interesting look at the brain and this idea that when the brain evolved, we were a different kind of people. We had to hunt and gather our food, expend a lot of energy doing so. And so the brain evolved at a time when energy conservation was critical. And so it is reluctant to spend any energy doing voluntary things that it doesn't have to do. But flash forward to now, that's really what exercise is, voluntary exercise. The brain sees it as an extravagant expense and it goes out of its way to try to talk us out of it. Oh, do you even have time for that right now? Oh, you're tired, right? Like, you had a stressful day. Why don't we just sit here and relax and conserve energy? And so this dialogue that the lazy brain, it really does like make us lazy effectively.
And it makes us lazy because it's trying to protect us by allowing us to conserve energy, whereas it's actually not in our best interest to conserve energy at those moments.
No, we need to expend some energy. In fact, the brain expects the body to be at least moderately active. And this is how it regulates all systems of the body, including our appetite control. And so when we're not moderately active, all of these other systems get out of whack. So in order to overcome our lazy conservative brain's approach, we need a more rational approach. But in the moment, that emotional lazy approach really does dominate. So we need to plan ahead. We need to get out our calendar at the start of every week, block off our time to exercise in that calendar, and include things like what you'll be doing, who you'll be doing it with, when and where, just so that it takes all of the thinking out of it, so that when your lazy brain says, do we even have time to exercise? You could say, yeah, it's right there in my calendar. And then when the lazy brain says, oh, do you even have energy to exercise? Exercising is hard. You could say, well, my plan for today is not that hard. And so you can overcome these barriers by just simply having a plan.
Use that good old prefrontal cortex to plan and organize and have some logical thinking.
Absolutely.
give us some more motivation as to why we should be exercising. Possibly one of the best motivations, other than weight loss, healthy cardiovascular system, is the impact of exercise on our brain and our brain's health. Can you talk about that and from a mechanical perspective too?
I already mentioned about anxiety. So exercise is extremely beneficial at soothing an anxious brain. And it produces this resiliency factor called neuropeptide Y, which essentially calms the amygdala down. And the amygdala is our threat detection center. It responds with fear, sends shockwaves into the body in the form of stress. And people who have post-traumatic stress disorder or PTSD, they have a hyperactive amygdala. And neuropeptide Y soothes that amygdala down and actually protects people from who've experienced trauma. It protects them against developing PTSD. And so we can build more neuropeptide Y with exercise. And the really excellent thing about this is light exercise is all you need. So that's one of the beautiful things that exercise does. It also helps improve our mood. And so when we look at people who are suffering from depression, a lot of people are given antidepressant drugs. Unfortunately, the drugs don't work for everybody. Sure, they work for some and they're extremely life transforming. But for others, they actually don't work. They have this drug resistant form of depression, which isn't caused by low serotonin. It's likely caused by inflammation, actually. And so exercise is the medicine that they need because exercise reduces inflammation and it helps to keep their brain healthy and happy.
Yeah, in the book, you even mention that with two different groups of individuals with depression, one given exercise, another given their regular drug regime, those with exercise actually improved just as effectively as those who are on drugs.
Yeah. And when we do a head-to-head challenge of antidepressants versus exercise, it's technically a tie.
That's crazy.
Which is really amazing. I know, it's amazing. And many people don't know this. Unfortunately, the first line of defense and the first conversation is all around drug use, a prescription for an antidepressant, when in fact, the conversation should start with exercise.
Not to say that antidepressants aren't helpful. They can be extraordinarily helpful and they have their place. And I highly recommend them in the right circumstance. But know that you have all these other tools in your toolbox that you can use as an adjunct.
Absolutely. And even for individuals who do take antidepressants and benefit from them, they can use exercise as an ad hoc, as an add-on therapy, and it helps to reduce some of the negative side effects that they might experience.
So what is the right dose of exercise for somebody with anxiety or depression?
The research suggests that something as simple as 30 minutes of a brisk walk, a moderate to vigorous exercise, three times a week is enough to keep depression and anxiety at bay, so mitigating. And the benefits of exercise are really strong for preventing stress-induced mental illness. So many of us can experience anxiety and depression, even if we've never had a diagnosis before, after experiencing stressful events in our life or chronic everyday stress. The pressure of that can build into symptoms of anxiety and depression. But if we're exercising, it actually can help buffer against stressors getting to that point. And so it protects the brain. We've shown this in my lab. And the exercise that seemed to be most beneficial was the moderate exercise three times a week for about 30 minutes.
That seems like nothing. Now, if I'm somebody with anxiety or depression and I already go for a walk for 30 minutes three times a week because I walk to the grocery store and it's not working, what would you say? Is there a next level of exercise to recommend?
Yeah, so adding in those short bursts of activity, of intense activity, right? So if you're someone who suffers from a panic attacks or panic disorder, which often can go hand in hand with anxiety, these short bursts of activity are really beneficial. So maybe put in a hill on your route to the grocery store and sprint up it. Something just as simple as that is enough. Or take the stairs, feel your heart elevate. That can be really beneficial.
This is amazing.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. We all carry around different stressors, big and small. We talk about these often on Untangle. When we keep things bottled up inside, it can start to impact our health mentally, emotionally, and physically. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest, whatever it is. If this sounds like you, and it's a bit of all of us, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule and needs. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/untangle today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/untangle. Now over to untangle.
So we've talked about the positive effects on anxiety and depression. How about things like age-related cognitive decline? You mentioned earlier BDNF. Can you explain what that is and how exercise might help us keep our neurons connected as we age?
Yes. So this is one of the greatest gifts exercise gives, is this youthful brain. So research from my lab shows that when it comes to dementia risk, physical inactivity contributes to your risk as much as your genetics. If you're physically inactive, it can actually negate a healthy set of genes. So you can't change your genes, but you can change your lifestyle. And the benefits of exercise for brain health are tremendous. So when we exercise, we produce this growth factor called brain-derived neurotrophic factor, BDNF. And it's essentially a fertilizer for brain cells. It reports to the hippocampus as a primary site and increases the growth of newborn brain cells there. And when we have more brain cells in the hippocampus, we have richer memories. They're richer in detail and we're less likely to forget things. And so it really does protect us from dementia.
I can attest to this from a scientific perspective because I worked in a lab many years ago looking at the growth of new neurons in the hippocampus of rats. And what we would simply do is put them on a running wheel. And then after they were on the running wheel, count how many new neurons were born inside of that rat brain. Unfortunately, it meant the end of the rat to do that. And the results are startling. And so if you think about the impact of putting a rat on a running wheel can be so dramatic, the activity that we as humans engage in as we do our exercise actually has a corollary effect. It truly does create the birth of new neurons.
It's amazing. And this happens throughout the lifespan. So our research shows that you can get a 30% increase in your memory function from exercising. That's amazing. And that was within older adults who were over the age of 65 and hadn't been exercising. So it really is never too late to start.
So we've learned about a bunch of different factors that seem to be working in the brain. Neuropeptide Y, which seems to have a soothing effect on the amygdala, which calms the brain. BDNF, which stimulates the growth of new neurons, as well as the growth of general neuronal connections in the brain. We learned about lactic acid, which totally surprising to me, also stimulates the growth of new neurons. And then what about just the fact that moving moves oxygen and blood to your brain?
Yeah, it stimulates the prefrontal cortex. So it nourishes it with oxygenated blood. And this helps the prefrontal cortex, which is our logical, rational brain, think better, think more clearly, and think more creatively. And so the simple thing is when we sit for really long periods of time, the blood flow to the brain decreases. And so we need to be moving our bodies. I would say every 30 minutes, take a 2-minute movement break. And that is enough to increase oxygenated rich blood to the brain, to the prefrontal cortex, to help bring its functions back online so that you can stay productive all day long.
Everybody take note of this. Every 30 minutes, get up for 2 minutes. And I believe in your studies, you looked at a few different time courses. So you could, what happens if you got up for 4 minutes after an hour, 2 minutes after 30 minutes, 8 minutes after 2 hours? How did you arrive at 2 after 30 as being the key?
The 2 after 30, it's the frequency of it. And this wasn't a study that I did in my lab, so I'm not sure the logic behind it. But what we've shown in my lab is that if we take university students who are watching an online lecture and we give them a movement break about halfway through, or we give them a sedentary break where they can play on their phone, or they get no break, the exercise break group are able to stay focused, they have less mind wandering throughout the lecture, and they perform better on their test afterwards. So just this short 5-minute movement break in the middle of a 1-hour lecture was enough to help the students learn better.
That is amazing. So for anybody who says, I don't have the time to exercise, it's an investment. It gives you back time. It pays dividends both in the short term on your work quality and in the long term on your lifespan.
That's right.
That's fantastic. Can you tell us about some of the other studies you've been doing in your lab?
Yeah. So one, this has not yet been published, so hot off the press. This is in collaboration with some colleagues at McMaster, Dr. Shaw and Dr. Becker, where we actually used Muse headbands and the biofeedback meditation in combination with exercise. So we looked at it alone and in combination with exercise, and found that the combination of the two promoted synchrony within the brain networks that promoted focus and concentration better than either running or the meditation alone. So there's this synchronistic effect of combining mindfulness training with the Muse with the running, which is really amazing.
This is totally amazing. Also, just so that you know, Jennifer and I have never met before prior to meeting at the beginning of this call. I invited her on because I loved her book. Prior to meeting before this call, I had no idea that she had used the Muse in anything. So this is actually the first that I'm learning about it.
Yeah, so it's not yet published, so it's out soon. But the pandemic has created some really interesting restrictions on our research because of in-person research in Canada, at least, has been stalled. So we've been trying to come up with creative ways to measure the brain outside of the lab. And that brought me to looking at the Muse headband for sleep. We do a lot of research on sleep in the lab. So I tested it out on myself. And one day I exercised and one day I did not. And both nights I measured my brain activity while I slept. And just as the research shows, after exercising, I had deeper sleep, more delta waves, and I slept more soundly. I fell asleep faster. I had fewer midnight awakenings than when I didn't exercise. And this is supported by a huge body of research that I share in the book too.
This is amazing. Again, I had no idea that you used the Muse for this. It's very cool. So you use the Muse data to be able to see the depth of your deep sleep and the amount of time you spent in each sleep stage.
Yeah. It was really fascinating. And in the book, I talk about how you can not just use. So the bottom line is when you move more during the day, you sleep better at night. And this is noticeable in the Muse recordings, which I thought was really fun and amazing. But you can also train your body or train your brain so that it can use exercise like a reliable circadian rhythm. So like the sun is like our main point of reset. So when the sun rises, our brain locks in time with the sun, and this helps keep our circadian rhythm in time. But we can actually use exercise to do the same thing. So consistently exercising at the same time every day, making your exercise routine as reliable as the sun, can help synchronize your circadian rhythm to that. And that can help you fall asleep faster and sleep more soundly at night too.
And one of the tricks that I use to lock my circadian rhythm with exercise is if I want to shift my circadian rhythm earlier so that I'm up and alert in the morning, I will exercise first thing in the morning, go for a very brisk walk, do some jumping jacks and squats, jump on the bike early in the morning. And that allows me to fall asleep faster at night because now my circadian rhythm is anchored to earlier. And on days when I'm just discovering that over time I'm falling asleep way too early at night, like I put my kid to bed at 8 and I'm exhausted, I will then start exercising in the evenings, alerting and awakening my body. And then that ends up pushing my circadian rhythm further into the future. I'll fall asleep much more predictably at 10 p.m. instead of 8 p.m. And that will have set my new rhythm.
Yeah. And there's been studies done to find exactly when the best time to do that is. And these studies, I don't know who would want to volunteer for these studies, but they essentially wipe out your circadian rhythm by having you do these ultra short sleep cycles. So you're like asleep for an hour, awake for two, asleep for an hour, awake for two, for 3 days. And then they introduce exercise at various times. And just as your personal experience noted, exercising in the morning helps you wake up in the morning faster, or like earlier in the morning. And they've shown it even with high school kids. Teens are notoriously like to sleep in, but if they're up at 7 a.m. and running, it is easier for them to get up for school. They feel better. They think better throughout the day. And likewise, at the end of the night, for a lot of older people, they would like to stay up a little bit later, right? They're getting up too early and going to bed too early. And so exercising in the evening is really helpful for shifting the sleep schedule a little bit later.
So we've talked all about the benefits. We are all convinced that we should be exercising and perhaps exercising at the same time as we meditate to combine the effects of them. But we still have those parts of our brain that say, ugh, not now, not today. Can you guide us through some of the best methodologies to bring exercise regularly into our lives?
So the simplest trick is put it in your calendar. So schedule it ahead of time. Make it a priority. Treat your appointments with exercise the same way you would treat any of your work appointments or meeting appointments. That's a key thing. The other thing is get a why. Why are you exercising? Really remember the benefits that you have. And I would say that having a why, my why is around promoting my mental health. If I don't exercise, I don't feel good. And I know this. So even when I don't want to exercise, I know, I trust that at the end of that workout, I'm going to feel better. And having that why is really important, and remembering the benefits that you get. It helps you to push through that resistance, either whether it's biological or psychological, so that you can start working out. It's so much more fun for a lot of people to find it more fun to work out with a buddy or in a social group. And this, the camaraderie of working out together, going for a run together, that can help motivate a lot of people. And not only do you get the benefits of the movement, but you also get the brain health benefits of being socially active and socially engaged with each other.
One of our guests a few weeks ago, AJ Jacobs, offered a great tip. There's the typical, just break it up into tiny little steps. Put your running shoes by your bike so it's easy. The first thing you have to do is put on your running shoes. Don't worry about biking. Just do the first small step. So breaking it up into little steps. And another one that he offered that really resonated with me was thinking about your future self. So you come up with an image of you 20, 30 years down the line. And you're not exercising for you right now. You're exercising for that person 20 or 30 years down the line so that they will be all that they can be. And as soon as I hear that one, it gets to my heart. It's like, okay, I'm not doing this now.
And then the benefit is that every workout gives you a boost. So you don't have to wait for 20 or 30 years to get the real benefits. But yeah, it does protect you over the long term, but it gives you these immediate gifts right away.
This is fantastic. Thank you so much for opening your eyes to the multiple gifts of exercise and the mechanism of those gifts and inspiring us to bring a little more movement into all of our lives.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you. That was Dr. Jennifer Heiss. Dr. Heiss also talked about the research her lab was doing with Muse. Okay, I literally had no idea. I'd been connected to Jennifer through her book and wanted to dive into her content. It was only once we were connected for the first time today did I discover that she's used Muse in her research experiments. In one experiment, they used Muse along with exercise to quantify the magnified effect of exercise and meditation. In a second study, she's using Muse S to track sleep. Both Muse and Muse S are available for anyone to purchase and use to help you meditate, track meditation, and improve your sleep, as well as track it with a clinical-grade sleep tracker. It's used by scientists all over the world and has been published in over 200 studies. It's also helped 400,000 people improve their meditation and sleep. And you can find out more about how Muse can help you sleep and meditate at choosemuse.com. And if you're curious, you can use the discount code POD10 to get one yourself. Wishing everyone a lively week filled with movement and meaning. Till next week, when we'll be back here with more untangle.